Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello, welcome to a very special edition of the Following On podcast, as we continue to bring you archived editions of The Brilliant My Sporting Life. In this episode, TalkSport's Danny Kelly sitting down with the former Australian opening batsman Matthew Hayden to discuss his remarkable career in the game. We'll be re-releasing old editions of My Sporting Life every Friday here on Following On. Already re-released shows with Michael Holden, David Lloyd, so scroll back through the Following On feed to find those episodes. But for now, we bring you My Sporting Life with the Australian great Matthew Hayden.
Tonight, My Sporting Life features one of the greatest batsmen in the history of Test cricket, the Australian legend, Matthew Hayden.
And there it is, a century for Matthew Hayden, his 15th Test 100, his first in Perth.
My Sporting Life on Talk Sport.
Over the course of the next 2 hours, we'll hear how Matthew felt when he made a world record Test score of 380.
I just didn't really care. And I'd say that with all due respect as well. I had the attitude that it didn't matter whether I was going to get out, because I was scoring so freely that I was just in this massive ball of momentum that everything just pinged off the bat. And even when I sort of thought, oh, I might have mishit that, I had it the sense at least to think of which way is the wind coming, and you know, it ended up disappearing out of the ground. It was that kind of touch.
And to win the Ashes,
we wanted to take revenge on England because we'd been beat. We weren't happy about being beat. We believed that we were a better side, but we just had to put it together, both as partnerships, whatever that looked like, to mount that pressure on England that we knew that we were capable of doing, to deliver really what was the outcome of 2006.
On DAB Digital Radio and 1089 and 1053 AM. My Sporting Life on Talk Sport.
Yeah, Matthew Lawrence Hayden, born the 29th of October 1971 in Kingaroy in Queensland in Australia. Matthew is without question one of cricket's all-time great batsmen, having averaged over 50 in 103 tests for Australia, hitting no less than 30 centuries, including a then world test record of 380 against Zimbabwe in 2003. His exploits in the one-day international scene are no less impressive, averaging just under 44 in 161 appearances for his country, and he played a starring role in Australia's triumphs at both the 2003 and 2007 Cricket World Cups. Numerous personal accolades have also came his way, including receiving the prestigious Alan Border Medal and Test Player of the Year Award in 2002, being named the Wisden Cricketer of the Year in 2003, winning the ICC One Day Player of the Year Award in 2007, and he was appointed a member of the Order of Australia in 2010 for services to cricket and the community. On TalkSport this evening, the legendary figure of Matthew Hayden takes centre stage on My Sporting Life. Matthew, a huge welcome to My Sporting Life. Matthew, your upbringing is in Kingaroy, as we heard, very different from some of the people who have been the guests on the show. It's a peanut farm in the middle of Australia.
Yeah, look, a fair way inland, as you say. It's a 2.5 hour drive to Brisbane, which is the major city of the Queensland area. But growing up in the bush was a really unique experience. It was one that was filled with a lot of love, I've got to say. A lot of time together as a family. The unique scenario around our family life was that my extended family lived with me. My grandparents lived with me on our family estate. And it was a third generation, still is now, fourth generation family property. At that time, when my great-grandfather would have been around, he was pulling up stumps of timber. It's that kind of semi-forest country. And he would have had the big Clydesdales, you know, ripping those up.
Wow.
And I just think, what amazing courage that our forefathers had. Can you imagine in these times packing up everywhere, going to a land which you just had no understanding of whatsoever apart from the basics of life, and then starting afresh in communities which just had no infrastructure?
To people like myself, let's say, brought up in the middle of London, the idea that, you know, you can look in every direction and you're on the property of your family, that at 10 years of age you're driving a car around the property, because it must have been a remarkable way to grow up. And as you say, if I want to give some example of perhaps the size of the community you lived in, your mum was a teacher at the state high school in Kingaroy, but she also had a program on the local radio station.
Yeah, she was a broadcaster, Mum. For a long time, she ran Breakfast Radio, which is now owned by Southern Cross Austereo Media Group. She worked for many years. In fact, I was pretty much born on air. And then she left. Once she had me, she went back home. She left. And then as I got a little older, she went back to teaching, where she's a speech and drama and music teacher and a theatre teacher. So, you know, it was that very much that sort of background. The house was always really lively, I've got to say. Mum comes from an enormous family, and all the girls on her side of the family, her sisters, all had letters in music and speech and drama. So there was never a day that wasn't around the fact that you had music in your life and you were just really loving sort of, you know, the theatrical elements. In fact, one of the things that I enjoyed was featuring in The King and I when I was about four.
Oh, well.
and just loving it, you know. So I always did love the stage, I've got to say. But it was always in our life. So we had a really quirky background because Dad, you know, being on the land and from the land, had that influence in my life through growing peanuts and sorghum and navy beans, which makes the baked beans for you city slickers out there that don't know that. And, you know, obviously peanuts, but we also had cattle as well. So we had a broad cross-section of both agriculture and also grazing properties as well. So it was a wonderful way of life and very diverse. And I guess you can't ask for a better way to live the start of your life, having a broad cross-section of interests. And sport was really the feature.
I was going to say, Matthew, where did
Australia.
Sport come from?
Well, every weekend, you know, it was about culminating, you know, in some sort of sporting activity or event. So you were arriving, you know, in the actual town itself, and it was just game on. And these areas, you know, have got some speckled with some fabulous athletes. It was so important. It was a bit like a dance or a ball was to the broader population, but to the sporting community, everyone would come, you know, of a weekend and play cricket or play football. And just love it. And that was part of being, you know, a bush kid.
And and even when you went to school, I noticed, again, that when you went, let me get the name right, to the boarding school, the Marist College in Ashgrove, incredibly, it's possible to argue you weren't the most famous sportsman to come out of there at the time.
No, exactly. I mean, there's been a few, but John Eales is probably the most famous.
The great John Eales, the Australian
the great John
cricket
Eales.
Captain. Oh, sorry,
he was great
captain.
Then as well.
Yeah,
he was. He was a really interesting character because he was a huge figure of a man. Just even at that age, he carried this presence about him. And I was actually caught up with John not so long back, and he has no recollection of pretty much like all champions that you come across in life. They don't really understand their greatness, and it takes other people to point them out that, hey, mate, you did something pretty special here. Because he always thought he was a real battler at school, that he didn't really sort of fit in, that he certainly wasn't very good at any one thing, rugby or cricket. But interestingly, from where I saw it, I thought he had a huge status in the actual school itself. Plus, he was brilliant at cricket. He was outstanding at football. And so here we go again. The roundabout of life takes him in a direction where he is sort of struggling to come to terms with his own success and his own performances. And I think that's almost what made him the great champion that he was.
Matthew, I'll cut straight to a phrase I read in your autobiography. For a man who went on to make a vast number of runs in the Test arena, your arrival in the very high parts of first-class cricket, you describe as a marathon game of snakes and ladders. There's a lot of rejection in the early part of your career, isn't there?
Yeah, look, I think my whole career, actually, I always struggled to kind of get into any particular side right through youth cricket. I didn't grow really until I was around about 16. I was quite short and I loved to drink of milk and food, naturally, through writing 3 cookbooks. I love food, so I was quite wide as well. So I was barely considered an athlete, but I did have that real tenacity and determination that came with having been made feel the underdog for a long time and also just making myself feel like that. So I have to acknowledge that I didn't really belong, I don't think, in Test cricket for a number of years. But going back into sort of the early stages of first-class cricket, mm-hmm. I'll never forget ringing up Rod Marsh, who was the main coach of the National Institute of Sport here in Australia. And it was at a time when I was having to enrol in university. And I was doing a marketing degree. I had to sort of go, okay, well, what's my choice here? Is it to go down the path of professional sport, or do I plant myself back into educational studies and move forward that way? So I thought, look, I'll cut to the chase here. I knew that I'd been nominated from my state to go down to the National Academy. There were 6 members from each state that were invited down there, and then it was really up to the choice of the national committee to see whether or not you were going to get a Guernsey into that particular unit.
Right.
So I thought, look, I'll ring Rod, and I said, Rod, it's Matthew Hayden here, and it wasn't a particularly good start because he said, Matthew who?
Oh, my God.
which was no real surprise, I've got to say. Absolute Test icon and legend. Who the hell am I, a small country kid, you know, with a big dream? And then he sort of said, look, to cut to the chase, look, we're really only interested in players here that are going to go on and play first-class cricket. So, you know, at this stage, I can't see how that's going to happen. So, as it turns out, and look, I didn't take any offence to it, but I did take it within myself to think, you know what, one day I'm going to make sure that I'm in a position where I can say to Rod, you know what, mate, I am a Test cricketer.
You used it as motivation and fuel.
I did.
Yeah.
I did, you know, and I think somewhat of my psyche sort of relies on the best way to get me to do something is to tell me I can't do it. So, you know, I did use a lot of that, internalize and used a lot of that sort of combustion for moving forward in my life. And safe to say, they came up about a week and a half later, the Youth Academy. And at the time, I actually got picked for Queensland. So it was a great advantage because I could have been at the academy, but instead I was actually playing with Alan Border, Ian Healy, Craig McDermott, coached by Jeff Thompson at the time, Carl Rackerman, all these champions.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it was a great learning grounds, as is the AIS, a great learning grounds for your actually game advancement. But, you know, I dusted him up. I got out on about 186 and I was ropeable, thinking, you know, I should have got 386 here. But, you know, that kind of set my chain alight. You know, I was sort of unfashionable because I wasn't particularly flamboyant. I just had a method of getting a large volume of runs. I was particularly limited against spin growing up on fast green wickets that Queensland provide you as a youth cricketer. So there was a lot of things that just weren't really gelling in terms of being a very good cricketing property across a multiple of different venues. And I had to work really hard at actually exploring elements of my game, being prepared to go through the really painful process of tearing your game apart. You know, that real analysis is a really painful place, especially when you're trying to carve out your living from it as well.
So,
you know, I was really very determined, however, to just make sure that I was getting better every single day.
Whatever happened in those early stages, you eventually make your way into the Queensland team in the winter, our summer of 1991. And then there's a really, I think, a very interesting interlude in your career, part of your learning curve as well, when you come to this country to play in the Bolton League. You play for Greenmount Cricket Club, and people, yep. This might have been a passing episode in your life and career, Matthew, except for the other people who were involved. Tell us something about Greenmount Cricket Club and what you did that year here in England.
Well, you know, I've looked back at a lot of my career with fabulous memories, but I've got to say in the top three would be my experience playing in the Bolton League at Greenmount Cricket Club. I was welcomed there firstly with absolute open arms. You know, I'd stumbled across two very infamous at the time young men called the Neville brothers, Gary and Philip.
Wow.
And both of them were playing within the side. In fact, I can remember, and I'm an absolute hack, I've got to say, when it comes to, I've got three left feet when it comes to a soccer ball. So I always sort of was curious to know why they were a little cautious about getting anywhere near me. But at the time, that was when, the great Sir Alex Ferguson had started up this youth academy, and they were really the first to be enrolled, you know, within Man United youth academies.
Yeah.
And they were regularly going, and on the weekends they'd come back and they'd play cricket. And typical of their careers as well, Philip was a high finesse player in cricket, a particularly strong player, was a bit of an all-rounder, but a very good batsman, solid in the field. Gary was an absolute thrashing machine, you know, really aggressive and just loved the fight. And, you know, that's how they went on also to play their footy, isn't it, as well. And every weekend, I'd go down. I had a sub pro, his name was Chris Holding, and we'd go down to the Nevilles and have a fabulous meal with them. We'd watch the footy. And in, you know, that particular time, Sky TV was only just starting to happen on the platform. So it was about going down there and watching sport and having beautiful Sunday roasts.
This is probably a difficult question to answer, Matthew, but if they hadn't been footballers, do you think either of the Nevilles could have been professional cricket players?
I reckon Gary, no. Sorry, Gaz.
Yeah.
I don't think he had probably the ability, but Phil most definitely did have the ability. He had the class that was required to survive within cricket, and he obviously had the athletic ability as well. So those memories were particularly fond, to play with men, to hear the stories, to drink the bitter, you know, to have the Sunday afternoon teas, to see the rattle of the tin go around the ground, to be living on my own, you know, in another country. I tell you, it just, honestly, it was the best experience. I just seemed to grow 10 years of age in that particular time. I loved every second of it.
It's almost like going to a university abroad or something like that. It just changes you as a person. Let's talk about, you're making some progress in first-class cricket in Australia as well, and very quickly you're getting into Australian teams. You made your one-day debut in this country, I think,
it was a Texaco trophy ahead of the Ashes series.
And
I wasn't good enough. That's the bottom line. I just wasn't, you know, like I was certainly, I'd had sort of 7,000 or 8,000 first-class runs behind me. By the time that I was sort of really starting to strike my straps. But, you know, in those early days in 93, I'd probably only had 2,000 or 3,000 runs behind me. I'd started playing really nicely in one-day cricket domestically, but I'd had no real experience. And as a rookie going into those conditions, in fact, England was always my nemesis full stop, because I found it the most challenging place to play in international cricket. I always felt like it took me too long to kind of warm up and get my feet back into the conditions. So it was probably no surprise, really, that I didn't really kind of set the world on fire, you know, early doors in my career. But simply put, I just wasn't advanced enough in my game and my overall game to really make a fist of first class of international cricket,
well,
at that sort of 93 stage.
Well, yeah, in March of 94, in Johannesburg, a moment that most Australian kids seem to dream about. You play for the full national team in a Test match as well, and we'll come on in the next part of the show to talk about how difficult it was for you in those first few years as an Australian Test player. But just try and remind me of how you felt walking out for the first time. Do you get the baggy green cap in a little ceremony before the match? How does it work?
Well, actually, then no. It arrived in a brown paper bag, which was at the bottom of your team kit when you got selected to play and go on tour. And I'll never forget mine because I had this dirty big box of kit arrive for the 93 Ashes tour. I threw everything out on top, and right at the bottom was actually this little bag that was just in brown paper, and I thought, that's got to be my baggy green. And I had my family around the table with me when I opened the bag up. There was two baggy greens in that particular time. It was only to the Stephen Waugh era that kind of made it one cap, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
So when I opened it up, you know, I had my dad basically saying how proud he was of me. My brother, who was coach at the time, you know, going through all of the work and what we'd achieved together even before we'd arrived at that stage. Mum was a mess, you know. She was saying how much she loved me and was so proud of me, you know, coming from the place that we did. And, you know, here we are, you know, sitting as a family member on a global stage was a really significant thing for our family. And I'll never forget it. You know, that night, I'll unashamedly say that I went to bed with my baggy green cap on. Safe to say, I didn't wake up with it in the morning, gee, I loved it. You know, I loved the thought of it. The clubhouse sort of thinking was exactly where I wanted to be in my life.
Matthew, we heard there about your test debut in South Africa in 1994. It didn't go that brilliantly, and I guess there's no other word to express it. You were dropped, and you didn't play again then for a test match, until 1996. I'm going to be even crueler rather than stating those facts. There were even people who were starting to make comparisons with our own Graham Hick, a marvellous domestic player who couldn't translate it necessarily in the international stage. What do you remember about that sort of those years of again being in the wilderness?
Well, look, I think you have to put it in context with where the side was at the time. Like even in 93, you know, where I didn't play a test match, went on tour with the absolute running of the selection being picked in the first three Texaco Trophy games. And everyone back home had fully expected that I'd play the first Ashes test alongside Mark Taylor. But when that didn't happen and Michael Slater got that opportunity, and rightly so, he really sort of took matters into his own hands, and Mark Taylor was exactly the same. And the trouble with being an opener, of course, is that there's only two spots in the lineup that you've got an opportunity to go take. And look, the calibre of players that were on that tour in 94... You know, the Alan Borders, the David Boones, the Mark and Steve Waughs, the, you know, Mark Taylor, as I just mentioned, Michael Slater on the top of his game and just beating the world down. And then lists of players that were sitting behind that, like Damian Martin, Ricky Ponting, Darren Lehman. You know, these guys, Stuart Law, that they were just fabulous cricketers. So it was a very, very hard-nosed landscape to actually be a part of and actually get into the side. Plus, you've got to also remember culturally the background, having been led by Alan Border, who was very, very determined to make the Australian cricket team, along with Bob Simpson, something special and something unique to this country. He was going to take no prisoners along the way. He needed tough, hard men with good work ethics that loved to play hard, but also enjoyed themselves off the field. You know, there was always that theory of good tourists and bad tourists. Good tourists being the ones that would work hard and play hard. Bad tourists, you know, just not selfish and not being a part of the whole culture and wrapped up in the culture. You know, so, you know, I ticked a lot of the boxes, but fundamentally, I had to beat Mark Taylor and Michael Slater into the side, and they'd formed a very unique bond in firstly the five test matches that they played in England, and then in the summer they came out and they played equally as well. So my call-up was always on a very temporary contract, if you like.
I mean, you've made the point beautifully there that just the depth of the Australian cricket, particularly in the batting area, because I can remember summer after summer here in England, you mentioned two players there, Darren Lehman and Stuart Law, who dominated the English summers in county cricket, and we could never understand, well, how can they never play for Australia, or very, very rarely play for Australia? But of course, that would say something about the depth of the team. In 1990s...
Yeah, sure. I mean, you draw a line across the old teletext, draw a line across the averages and aggregates, and you'd always see, you know, the top six or seven players with both bat and ball through that era in county cricket being pretty much Australians.
Absolutely.
So it was a tough era to play in.
In 1996, first of all, we should say important moment in your life in that you marry Kelly. And we'll talk later about your family life, if I may. And the Australian selectors, goodness, this is almost incredible, isn't it? They did make the decision in the middle of the of all of this that Michael Slater is going to be taking out the Australian team. This is despite averaging 47 in his 34 tests. And even then, they don't replace him with Matthew Hayden. It's Matthew Elliott who gets in the team, which itself itself sparks a newspaper campaign in Australia for your inclusion in the side.
That campaign was interesting because that campaign in particular, it did strike a couple of very negative chords within the Australian cricket camp, and I think it's kind of negatively impacted on me to a certain degree anyway, because the Queensland people are very parochial, as are the other states as well. But, you know, when they feel like there's something happening which is not quite right, they blow up. And as you say, in the background of pretty much every camera angle, I think they had someone working inside Channel 9 to say, hey, mate, you need to flash over to this particular sign that this little kid's holding up that says, give Matt a bat. And in fact, you know, that headline then, you know, Matt the Bat was always sort of coming up, you know, through various times in the year when I kept on chipping away at, you know, certain records within state cricket.
Yeah.
But to be very honest, look, I just kept my nose to the ground and just really ground out runs and constantly got better every day. Like I can remember through that period as well, down at Hampshire, having some wonderful memories with, you know, guys like Robin Smith, who played the game hard but had a really good work ethic as well and had fun off the pitch. Malcolm Marshall, who, you know, the most beautiful man and the most talented cricketer that I've ever seen. Yep. You know, having him as a mentor, talking about swing bowling and him coming out and having private sessions with me. And then we'd sneak back into the bar and have a couple of rums and a few cherries, you know, after the actual performances. But, you know, those guys just made such an enormous impact on me as a cricketer and really made me sort of improve as well and made me fall in love with the game and made me desire being a better cricketer every day and planted those seeds for me to grow and develop. And then, you know, my time as captain of Northants, you know, on really turning wickets where, you know, Brownie and a young Graham Swan, you know, were very much a part of the arsenal of the Northampton cricket team.
Yeah.
And having an opportunity there to play in those conditions, you know, for 2 years at the back end of the season, when everyone was saying, oh, how come, you know, Matty's not on the Ashes squad and where is he? And he's just fallen off the radar. But, yeah, that may be true from an international stage, but what sat next to that was this fantastic nutrients that were coming out of and really sort of adding a great weight to my cricketing performance. And I took everything, and my wife did as well, every experience that we had. You know, we loved the cultures that we were involved in. We gave a lot back to those communities of people. And in turn, we actually, you know, were able to grow out of it as well and just loved it.
Matthew, you get back into the Australian test team having on the back of this newspaper campaign, but unfortunately Matthew Elliott gets an injury and you play in the third test. It's your first home test, of course. You play in the third test in Melbourne against the West Indies, and you don't do very well. But of course, again, I'm not really blaming you, because of course your wicket is taken both times by Curtly Ambrose, who I presume at that stage was absolutely in his pomp. Yes.
Yeah, he was. And look, I was terrified, I've got to say as well. That was my first Boxing Day test match.
100,000 people.
100,000 people. You know, this city, this country kid that has, you know, arrived at the Big Smoke. Your room, for goodness sake, had the curtains and they looked out over the Coliseum of the MCG and you knew what you were in for the next day. So, look, I was petrified and I'll never forget, you know, walking off after leaving the first ball off Curtly Ambrose and my off stump tumbling out towards the wicketkeeper. And they're all going absolutely bananas like they do in the West Indies. And I walk back through the pack. And I've got to say, it's a long way off the MCG.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I come to the members area. And, of course, as you say, I replaced Matthew Elliott. So they weren't that happy about that. And I finally got up through the change rooms doors. And I thought, oh, my teammates will be here to give me support. I opened the door and they had all their heads down.
Oh,
but it
dear.
Just doesn't, it doesn't stop there either. Then you have to go through three flights of stairs along a big corridor and then into the dungeon, which would make a good cellar. So there I sort of stayed, you know, on ice for the better part of 5 days and just, it was a really tough, thing to do, I can tell you.
And then it turns around the next test, Matthew. Let's hear about how in the fourth test in Adelaide, you make your debut test 100. Tell me about that.
Well, firstly, Adelaide Oval's a very unique and sacred place to play. It's kind of the old school of it's a bit like the Lords, I suppose, right. of county cricket and English cricket. It's you know, it's a fabulous place, a lot of tradition. I've always very, very much enjoyed going there as well. It's pretty much always a turning wicket. And by that stage as well, I was starting to really improve my game against spin bowling. They had also Ambrose out, and he was a real nemesis. So I always kind of fancied myself a bit against Big Cuddy Walsh, because he always took the ball away from the left-hander. So, and I felt comfortable leaving cricket balls,
mm-hmm.
whereas Ambrose always... You never knew which way it was going to go, which was just... So you always kind of were left thinking, oh, I've probably got to play it. But yeah, look, it was at the time, I think it was recorded one of the worst hundreds that anyone had ever seen at international cricket.
Really? Oh.
Well, I got caught off a no ball for a start. I think it... Whether it was... I can't remember if it was Ambrose or Patterson. Skewed off the sort of top edge of my bat and I got caught at gully somewhere. But it was a no-y, so that was kind of my first lifeline. I think that was a bit harsh. Like, it wasn't my best performance, but, you know, it was a pretty dogged, more along the lines of what my career looked like at the time. I'd occupy the crease, I knew how to get runs, and I wouldn't sort of change the fly too much, so to speak. I'd just swim between the flags and be safe and be assured of the fact that I was going to bat a long time. So it wasn't pretty. But, you know, probably didn't deserve to be slated the worst 100 everyone
No, I mean, for a start, not everybody can... We can't remember every single 100 and how bad they were, can we?
No, well, every 100 that you get's a good 100, in my opinion.
That seems about right to me. That seems about right. Were your family there to see all this, Matthew?
This is how great my family is. My mum and dad drove down from country Kingaroy, and my brother with them as well for both the Boxing Day Test match and also the Adelaide Test match. And to put that into perspective for you, that's a full 40-hour drive. So, you know, imagine if you set off in your car from London and drove 40 hours in and across, you'd get to just about the other side of Russia, I reckon.
Well, you get past Moscow, I think. Yeah, you would.
Yeah, so, you know, it's a long way and the tyranny of distance, but they were there every second of the way to support me. And, you know, one of the finest ales that I've ever consumed was with my mum and dad and my brother. At that particular time, you know, where I've got a test match 100 and, you know, we've had that point in our life where we go, you know, we've done it once, it might be just possible to do it again.
Matthew, in this section, I want to talk about a time in your life where we've talked about your maiden test century in 1997. 4 or 5 years later, you are one of the cricketers of the year, scoring double hundreds in difficult circumstances away from Australia. And yet in the middle of all that, we have another situation where you don't go to England for the 1998 Ashes series and another three-year absence from the Test arena. And given the figures that you piled up, it's almost impossible to believe that once again you were out of the team. Tell me
well,
about...
Well, the selectors had rocks in their heads, didn't they?
Well, yeah, but look at what you did after that suggests that you're right. They would say, of course, that by keeping you out of the team, they're right, which is true.
Yeah, well, they kept me on ice for a long time, there's no doubt, and kept me wondering or pondering, you know, what more I really needed to do. And with good reason as well, I didn't really... Like, even when I look back at sort of after that first century that I got against the West Indies... I hadn't really nailed my opportunity. You know, it's a pretty tough school as well. I think if you don't average between 40 and 50 in your first, you know, 10 games, you're pretty much on notice, really. And that's why I think this great Australian side and the generations before it have just demanded excellence. And I fully understand and have empathy for that scenario. And then when I went to South Africa... to play a three-test match series, and it's a difficult series number to play as well, I've got to say. You know, you fail in the first game and you're under pressure in the second, and if you don't really rise to that, then on the third you're pretty much on the chopping block, and really that's exactly what happened. And they were a very good side as well. They're a highly talented side. Farnie de Villiers, Donald, Craig McMillan. They had a very, very good side, and they knew their conditions well. They probably were a bit limited with the spin bowling at that particular time, but, gee, they really put us under pressure. And as a side, we were starting to shift. You know, Alan Border, that would be his final season as well. So he was sort of starting to feel the pressure, and You know, just all of those things kind of add up. You know, change of leadership, Mark Taylor. You know, Mark never did me any favours because he's a left-handed opening batsman.
Sure.
Well, hello, so am I.
Yeah.
And look, we didn't pull any punches, you know, when we were actually playing New South Wales versus Queensland together, or in fact Australia A in Australia. So, you know, I was all over him like a cheap suit, and he didn't want to actually give over his spot, and I don't blame him for that. So, you know, I really had to work very hard to just stay in the actual presence of the selectors, because it's not like when I arrived at Test cricket that I was giving him a lot of solid information to say, hey, he's our huckleberry, let's keep him in the side.
Sure.
So, you know, you often hear these cliches that it is what it is. Well, it was what it was. That was where I was at.
You come back into the Test side in at the turn of the millennium, but not before we should talk about this. You had a pretty hair-raising boating accident yourself, Andrew Simmons, of course, a great cricketer himself, and fishing writer Trent Butler. I know you're a pretty outdoors kind of guy. What happened here?
Well, I do love the outdoors.
This is January 2000, so right at the millennium, yeah.
Yeah, right on Christmas it was, and Christmas is known as cyclone season up here, so we get a lot of swell on our east coast, and we were staying over the Christmas period over at a little place called North Stradbroke Island. This particular Christmas, Simo and I had a small boat together. Both of us loved our fishing. It was as much a part of our life as what cricket was and family is. So we were out in the morning with Trent Butler, as you said. We didn't really know Trent that well. He was a fishing writer. We thought we'd just invite him along so he could take some pictures and write a bit of a yarn. But what turned out was the fact that we were sitting right in the middle of a bank of waves, and it turned our boat over in the middle of the night, pretty much. It was about 3 o'clock in the morning, right before the sunrise, and we had to swim for a little over an hour in this quite extensive channel. It's about an 8 or 9 kilometre wide channel, and we were sitting on the probably about a K offshore.
Wow.
So we had to swim back in for our lives. And thankfully we did, because, look, it could have, Danny, been a very different story. In fact, we got about halfway through the swim and Trent was starting to really knock up. As you know, you couldn't blame him for that. We had big waves.
Yourself and Andrew are professional sportsmen. You're both incredibly strong guys. But a swim in a kilometre is a pretty, in a current, it's a difficult, difficult thing.
Well, you're in shock as well. It's not like you're supposed to be in the water at that particular time. So it's not like you're planning to, you're putting your swimming cap on, your goggles, and you're going for a swim. It's not that easy. So, yeah, at one point, Simo and I turned to each other and said, look, we might have to actually, you know, control the situation here. We might have to actually dust him up and, you know, make sure that he's not going to drown us and then therefore drown himself also. Because panic is a funny thing in life, isn't it? It can send you and do crazy things to you. So, yeah, in the end, we ended up having to rescue him. We got over there's two banks always pretty much in Australia. You've got an outer bank and an inner bank. And he got bashed by these waves on the outer bank and he was going down. So we dragged his hands up and Simo and I got either side of him and dragged him up to the shore, and there some local fishermen picked us up. And by that stage, there was also helicopters that were capturing the story and were doing figure eights in and around the bar to search, you know, if there was any survivors or where we were, really. So it was a very relief and welcome call when we rang home and said to our respective partners that we're safe and everyone's well, and the only thing that's really gone down is our boat, which was just bobbing up and down like a cork in the water.
Listen, thank you very much for telling us about that. You come back into the Test team in Test against New Zealand and the West Indies, and then you head to India with the Australian team. I should make the point that this Australian team by this stage has won 15 matches in a row over 15 months, which just shows you the kind of standards they were setting. And that series, I remember very, very distinctly, that series between India and Australia has gone down as one of the great series in Test cricket history. And it's also the one where finally, I think it's fair to say you established yourself not just in the Australian team, but on the world cricketing stage.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I'd really I'd really come of age, if you like, for better segment of words. It was at a time where I pretty much thought to myself, I can't do any more improving here. All I have to do now is just go bat the way that I've now taught myself, and those around me have done that, so I can really just launch into that platform. I've done a lot of work, including the couple of years at Northampton on big turning tracks. I'd come back home. I'd done a lot of work. I was geared up and ready to play on spinning wickets. I was fit as a mallee bull. I was really determined. You know, the ducks in a row were just all there, and all I had to do was just grab the opportunity. And that's exactly what happened. I was ready to play. Someone like Harbison was telling me that I couldn't do it, which, as I said before, was just, you know, right up my alley. The pressure was off in a lot of ways, I felt, in those conditions, because the balls were turning so far that, you know, it meant that every ball had to be accurate, otherwise it was easy picking. So, you know, it was just my time, I think, and I grabbed it with both hands and just loved every second of it.
You certainly did. You played in a wonderful series, including in the third test in Chennai, your first double ton, 203 for you, Matthew. Most people would be very happy to have that as their all-time top test score. But as we're going to hear later on in the show, and of course you've gone to nearly double that. You also played over here in the 2001 Ashes series. And as I say, finally established yourself in an Australian team that you are going to go on to have tremendous success with, and have tremendous success as an individual. We'll hear about that in the second part of the show. Now, though, coming up here next on My Sporting Life, we'll put Matthew Hayden through his Sporting Inquisition.
Your Sporting Inquisition on Talk Sport. Matthew Hayden.
You know the drill, about 15 quick-fire questions for Matthew Hayden. Starting, Matthew, with what's your favourite sporting venue?
MCG.
Okay. Who's been your toughest individual opponent?
Kirtley Ambrose.
What's your favourite city?
London.
Wow. Oh, sorry, I've got to
expand. Ooh, controversy, wasn't it?
No, that's
you
great.
You didn't expect that one, did you?
No, I didn't. Why is London your favourite city?
Oh, I just think it's fabulous. It's history. It's like the Monopoly board. Perfect.
What's the best car you've ever driven?
Ferrari. Warnies, actually.
Oh, do you have a favourite driving song?
Anything James Taylor.
Okay, now here's a tricky one for you. Since you threw me the London one, Brian Lara or Ricky Ponting?
Ooh. For my life, Ricky Ponting.
Okay,
for just beauty, Brian Lara.
Okay. What's your favourite drink?
Red wine.
If you could be a star in any sport except cricket, which one would you choose to be a star in?
Surfing.
Of course, you're in this country, we call you a surf bum, but you are a big surf fan, mm-hmm. aren't you? Yeah.
Who would you love it?
Who might you pick to play you in a film, Matthew?
Oh, gee, Brad Pitt. No idea why.
Very good choice. Is there a book you wish you'd written?
I'd like to write a barbecue book. Yes.
You write you write cookery books.
Barbecues
don't you?
Of the world book.
Yeah, because you write cookery books, don't you? Yeah.
I do, yeah.
Which historical figure do you most admire?
Historical figure? Nelson Mandela.
Yeah, it's a pretty good answer, isn't it, in this time in our lives. Who's your favourite cartoon character?
Wile E. Coyote.
Meep meep, etc. finally, we're going to talk about a lot more in the next hour or so. What's your best moment in cricket?
Probably either of the two World Cup victories, the one in South Africa or the West Indies. They're both good. One was a little less farcical than the other two,
yeah,
I might add.
That's
the one
fair.
The West Indies didn't conclude correctly, but there you go.
But we'll hear about both of those in the next hour, because that is it for the first half of tonight's edition of My Sporting Life here on Talk Sport with Matthew Hayden. We'll be hearing more from him over the next hour.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
On DAB Digital Radio and 1089 and 1053 AM. My Sporting Life on Talk Sport.
I'm Danny Kelly. Welcome to part two of My Sporting Life with Matthew Hayden here on Talk Sport. And Matthew is without one question, one of cricket's all-time great batsmen, having averaged over 50 in 103 tests for Australia, hitting no less than 30 centuries, including a then world test record of 380 against Zimbabwe in 2003. His exploits in the one-day international scene are no less impressive, averaging just under 44 in 161 appearances for his country. And he played a starring role in Australia's triumphs at both the 2003 and 2007 Cricket World Cups. Numerous personal accolades have also come his way, including receiving the prestigious Alan Border Medal in 2002, being named a Wisden Cricketer of the Year in 2003, winning the ICC One Day Player of the Year Award in 2007, and being made a member of the Order of Australia in 2010. On tonight's My Sporting Life, I'm joined by one of the truly great batsmen of cricket's modern era, Matthew Hayden. Matthew, welcome back. After your phenomenal series in India in 2000-2001, you established your partnership with Justin Langer. And what happens over the next few years, it would be impossible for us to do justice to on this programme because there are so many highlights. Just let me remind people that in the years 2001...
It'd be a bit embarrassing for a start, though, because there'd be way too much hugging involved, which have some sensitivities around it. The man crush, as they called it.
2001, 2002, 2003, 2004, 2005. You score 1,000 test runs in each of those years. Australia also winning all around them. If I may, if you can pick out some highlights for me if you like, but I'd like to talk about two things in this section in particular. Australia's victory in the 2003 World Cup in the one-day team, which, of course, you're also an integral part of, and Australia are all-powerful. And then later on, if I may, I'd like to talk about the time when you break the test scoring record with a fantastic innings of 380. Talk to us about the World Cup win in 2003, if you would.
Well, as you remember, it was actually plagued, the start of it, by the controversy with Shane Warne in the drug scandal. So the group really had a lot of work to do in the initial stages of it. And I've got to say, like, going into that particular tournament, there wasn't one person that in the room that didn't believe that they weren't going to be at the back end of the series holding the World Cup up and being undefeated. That's just the way the side kind of was thinking at that period of time.
I think you were already champions, weren't you?
Well, I think in our own heads we were.
Oh, okay.
There's no doubt about it. You know, and I mean that in a... That sounds a bit arrogant, but I do mean that in a way that everyone had a very same or similar story to what I'd had. You know, guys like, for example, Adam Gilchrist, who was a phenomenon in himself. He virtually changed the landscape of cricket by the fact that he was such a dynamic batter with this enormous capability with the gloves, very, very non-technical, but just explosive and explored.
I mean, Matthew,
and had this great freedom. You know, that's just one guy.
Your colleague Adam Gilchrist has changed the game of cricket forever. He has knocked the all-rounder out of cricket, hasn't he? Because now the wicket-keeper batsman is the all-rounder in the team.
Yeah, it seems that way. And look, he probably humbly wouldn't have sought after doing that. But you know, someone like Gilly, he, as you say, he virtually was just one member of the side that had this great aspiration. And as a young person, the ball, when it hit his bat, it had a different sound. It was just this clean, absolutely crisp pop, just, and it just disappeared. But Gilly always had something really special. And so, you know, when you're actually sitting down at the other end of the wicket watching just this onslaught of really just domination, it was very hard not to actually improve as a player and to really sort of get sucked up into this momentum that the side just seemed to have, and this confidence and this kind of aura that surrounded the group. And so when Warnie went down, it kind of just put a bit of a chink in the armour for a couple of days ahead of the World Cup. But then Brad Hogg, you know, came up and just lifted. And he had such a fabulous South African World Cup that it was just ridiculous. You know, so there was always guys, the culture bred this kind of self-perpetuating player of success and immense confidence and just this belief that they had that would sweep them up and would make them better than what they currently were before they came into the side.
And sure enough, despite the setback of losing Shane Warne, and let's be fair, what a setback that is to any team in the world in the entire history of cricket, you do win all the pool games, you're unbeaten in the Super Six, the second round of the tournament, beat Sri Lanka in the semi-final. What do you remember about the final against India in Johannesburg?
Well, you know, it was one again of just complete domination. I think we were sort of, if we were going to fall, we were going to fall actually in Port Elizabeth. And Michael Bevan and Andy Bickle had a fabulous tournament as well during that World Cup in South Africa. If we're going to fall, we're going to fall there. So when we came to India, my recollection is us winning the toss, batting, and Gilly just absolutely teeing off on Zahir Khan in the first over, and Zahir has, you know, this great presence as well in the middle, and the backing of a nation, you know, of 1.4 billion strong. Here we are, 25 million strong, thinking how good we are, and yet there's this weight of performance that has to go around a nation like India. And, you know, if a one man metaphorically could reach into someone's heart, split the chest and pull it out, that was Adam Gilchrist in the first over. I think he'd scored something like 15 or 16 in that first over. And I thought from that moment on, Australia had the World Cup sewn up one over.
Of course, it was a very one-sided final, as you say, crushing domination. And for your benefit and I hope for your enjoyment, let's hear the moment when Australia clinched the 2003 Cricket World Cup.
That's in the air, should be taken. The World Cup for Australia. A comprehensive win here by 125 runs.
Well, they've put a lot of work into that and they've played extremely well all the way through.
Yeah, Australia, they're winning the 2003 World Cup. And it was later in that year, Matthew, where in the middle of this astonishing run of scores and centuries you were putting together with yourself and Justin Langer in what turned out to be one of the great opening partnerships in Test history, you, in the first test against Zimbabwe at Perth, made jumping off the page in front of me here, made 380 runs in a single innings. Let's just play some of the highlights of that amazing innings.
And there it is, a century for Matthew Hayden, his 15th test 100, his first in Perth.
On his plate, a cracking shot. Don't worry about fieldsmen. You can't stop that.
Oh, it's all happening. Have a look at that. That's a magnificent shot straight down the ground for six. He is absolutely murdering Zimbabwe.
There's the 300 for Matthew Hayden. Direct hit. He's happy that he's home, though. And he's just the second man to make a triple century in Test cricket in Australia.
And that's it. That's a great shot. Up go the arms of Matthew Hayden. That is the world record. What a performance.
I mean, Matthew, maybe every scoring record you've ever had will be taken away from you by some prodigy in the future. Who knows? But they can never take away.
I hope it does happen.
They can never take away from you the fact that for one while there, you were the highest scoring batsman in a single test innings ever. That's a badge you can wear forever. What were your feelings as that innings were unfolding? And when you finished 380, what were your feelings?
Well, if I can take you to the end before the start.
Yeah.
I'd walked in the dressing room ahead of breaking that record. And, you know, I've never been one for all these records. And I certainly, I mean, it was courageous that Mark Taylor basically was to declare on the great Donald Bradman's record. But I thought personally, without being disrespectful, I thought that was a nonsense. I thought that records were made to be broken.
Yeah, of course.
And I rightfully say that I hope, and it already has. You know, it's got broken in 9 months, and I was delighted for Brian Lara that he went on to make 400. But my concern was actually when I went into the dressing room at tea time before I broke at that time world record, I went up to Stephen Waugh, and I said, mate, surely we have got enough runs. I mean, we can win this test match today. Let's just do it. He said, no. He wanted no bar of it.
No.
He said, mate, I want you to go on and get 400. And I said, well, Tug, you know, I'm just embarrassed, mate. Like, honestly, like, how much more do we really need? He said, I don't care. Just go on. Just bat. So when I got out in the middle, it was kind of that attitude, actually, when I look back at it for maybe 150 runs. I just didn't really care. And I'd say that with all due respect as well. I had the attitude that it didn't matter whether I was going to get out because I was scoring so freely that I was just in this massive ball of momentum that everything just pinged off the bat. And even when I sort of thought, oh, I might have mishit that, I had it the sense at least to think which way is the wind coming, and, you know, it ended up disappearing out of the ground. It was that kind of touch. And I came over to Perth never having struck a ball in anger ahead of that test match. And so I spent the better part of 4 days ahead of that test match banging cricket balls and literally batting for like 4 5-hour sessions, like pretty much all day sessions. So much so that I actually did my back. And the physio at the time, Errol Orcott, had to actually fitness test me on the day of that particular match because I was in grave doubt. And I ended up sort of etching through the fitness test and playing. And, you know, that did have that sort of tag, oh, well, it was only Zimbabwe and, you know, it was the first game. What does it really matter? But, you know, there was this challenge leading up to the actual tournament as well, which was ahead of me. And just to play, when I really think back to it, it was probably a bit lucky. And I certainly, you know, there's a lot to be said for mental freshness as well. I mean, had that have been kind of, you know, three quarters of a way through a 10-month season, which we'd traditionally play both home and then abroad, you know, maybe I wouldn't be on that same mindset and have that freedom and that almost, you know, like spirit of the dolphin or spirit of the ocean, which is just sort of floating and being free. And, you know, I was creative and I just loved every second of it.
Let's move forward, if I may, to 2005. Of course, another very beautiful event for you in April of that year when you and Kelly had your second child, Joshua. And then some months later, a couple of months later, the 2005 Ashes series, it's still an incredibly fierce and clear memory for you who played in that series. I mean, look, let's be fair, Matthew. People in England have gone on to say that it's the greatest test series ever and it revivified test cricket. I don't think even Australians would deny that. It was an incredible summer, wasn't it?
No, we absolutely love a battle, and that's exactly what we had. And look, to put this game into perspective, and in particular, to look at the landscape of test match cricket, when it really comes down to it, and you hear people argue about, you know, 2020 cricket and, you know, one day cricket and the impact that it's had on the game, and you start to think, well, okay, how do you rationalise this performance and the measure, you know, which game is more popular than the other? When it all comes down to it, players and spectators may well love all formats of the game, but what they really want to play, you know, when you're part of Australia and when you're a part of an English society, what they really want to play is a test match. That's an Ashes test match. And I think spectators along with that get wrapped up in this great passion for the game, because it's not the same if it's another test nation, with all due respect, playing. The Ashes is the absolute pinnacle of it. You know it as a player, you know it as a spectator, and you want to be there. So when you're a part of something as thrilling as what we saw in 2005, it's unforgettable. And it carves its way into history like no other series.
And we should remind ourselves that Australia won the first test. I mean, this is almost lost in the gunfire of history now, that Australia won that first test. But even in the build-up to it, in your book, you say, and I trust you enough, Matthew, that you didn't just retrofit this, if you like, that you knew that something was happening with the England team. There was an incident involving Simon Jones in the build-up to it, and you got the impression that this was a different kind of England side.
I 100% have written that, and I completely almost can feel it.
It was a one-day game at Edgbaston,
about
wasn't it?
10 years ago. Edgbaston test match, Simon Jones, and it was always a bit of a pet hate of mine when a bowler, you know, threw the ball back at you and you were just standing in your crease.
And he hit you, didn't he?
He's got every right to do it. I mean, the fact is that there was a point in time where I thought, you know what, mate, I'm going to sort of put the acid on you here a bit. But what I found in that particular moment was that Simon Jones, and he was apologetic, and he's one of the great blokes too, by the way, Simon Jones. Yeah. He's a fantastic human being and one of the great blokes to actually play against, because he did have that real Welsh spirit and by gee, he would take no prisoners. But what I found at the tail end of giving him a bit of a serve and him coming up, you know, and sort of saying, I'm sorry, even though he did hit me, was the whole English side, for once, they were on his case and were really taking sides with him. And there was that presence around them that you thought, as an imposing player, you know, on English conditions, that we mean business here, this particular test match series. You know, so that to me was sort of... And the fact is, to just carry that on a little bit more, you had a great friendship that was starting to forge and emerge between Jones, Harmison, Hoggard and Andrew Flintoff. And anything that you look at within any champion side, you've got to have these champion units that sit in the side of it. You know, for Australia, it was Warne, Gillespie, Lee, McGrath, that was, you know, working as a foursome to just take any other side down. From a batting lineup, you know, like myself and Justin Langer and Ricky Ponting were the kind of engine room of the side through our particular era. You mess with one of us, you mess with all of us. And we're on your case if you do so. So for the first time, I just felt this sort of positive gearing towards the relationships within the English side. And for once, I sort of felt like the press, whilst they had their knives, you know, sharpening out amongst the tabloids, that we're going to be, you know, another public guillotining of, you know, the next captain of England. Or they had that edge to them after the first test match when we really crucified England at the home of cricket.
Absolutely.
There was that feeling, but for once I sort of felt there was a bit more to this side than what I'd felt in the past.
Well, let's reiterate the fact that Australia won the first test by 180 runs, and in many ways we thought, here we go again. The second test is bookended by two extraordinary events, both in their own way equally important. Glenn McGrath stands on a cricket ball, turns his ankle, and five days later, Michael Kasparovic, after that astonishing and agonising last wicket partnership, where Australia came within one stroke of winning the second test, and it had all been different. But it wasn't. I mean, this is one of the great and bizarre test matches, wasn't it?
It was. It was just, as you say, bookended is a really perfect summary of the series, because had Glenn McGrath have played that particular match, I would have thought that there would have been a very similar result, you know, as to the first test. He was just on top of his game. He was at his brilliant best. He loved the English conditions, and I think it would have gone Australia's way. But, you know, in some ways, as a sporting lover, ahead of just being a part of a fantastic team and a fantastic series, it was great that it played out the way it was, because, you know, it introduced Test cricket to something which we relive and we love about the game, that pure emotion and that distance and that test of time throughout a series, and that possibility of a result maybe not going the way, and all of the reasons why you love Test cricket was right there in front of us during that series and in our faces. And I'll never forget sitting next to Ricky Ponting for about an hour and a half, you know, like each one of us taking times to get up and rotate, just a very brief walk across to the center area where the coffee house was. and getting a cup of coffee and chewing nervously on our fingernails and whatever else we could put in our mouth at the time, probably some of those beautiful biscuits that they serve up at Edgbaston Cricket Ground. But, I mean, we were on the edge of our seats for too long. It was agony. It was emotional. It was horrific, you know. And then the expectations were that we were going to lose. But then over that 50-run partnership between Lee and Michael Kasperwich, the expectations suddenly almost turned to the other way when we got sort of 12, 11 runs out. The momentum was just shifting towards Australia. And then when the decision was made to dismiss Michael Kasperwich, it was just like a pack of cards that just tumbled down on the ground.
I know. It's almost better to lose by 100 than to lose by 2, isn't it?
Just about. But you know what it did do? It was nothing more than the making of a fantastic tournament and wonderful relationships, because who will ever forget, you know, the Andrew Flintoff moment when he crouched over the top of a Brett Lee who was crushed in defeat, this wonderful champion, and yet this beautiful moment of humility and this description of what it meant, you know, to be an athlete and to have that great compassion within a particular match where you embrace each other as human beings from two different countries, one on the wrong side of the result. But to me, that forged at least the next two Ashes series.
Yes.
But certainly in that moment, it forged this wonderful unison of the old guards coming together for this particular 2005 series, which was just magnificent.
Yeah, and I'll just remind people that at the third test, Brett Lee somewhat got his revenge when he and Glenn McGrath saw out incredibly an amazing draw for Australia. I remember the Australian celebrations on the balcony very well. England won the fourth test, with Ashley Giles and Matthew Hoggett eventually seeing them through. The final test at the Oval, somewhat anticlimactically, I thought was a draw. I happened to be lucky enough to be on the ground for the rather strange business of the umpires coming and going and looking at light and all the rest of it. You scored 138, and the series ended with, as I say, an English victory. Reverse swing was all the rage. Incredibly, that extraordinary 2005 series is followed, and it's one of the beauties of when the schedule of cricket in the globe works this way. Australia get an immediate chance for revenge. A great Australian team.
So do England.
They do indeed. They do indeed. A great Australian team. A team full of what you would describe as champions. Many of them coming to, let's be fair, the end of their illustrious careers. Can you remember apart from being bitten by a dog, and you might want to tell me about that as well, can you remember the build-up to the 5-6 Ashes series in Australia and what you expected?
Well, we were obviously very disappointed with our, both individually and collectively. I mean, there was a couple of key performers. Warney was a great performer in England over that 2005 series, but there was a lot of guys, including myself, that just didn't hit the mark during that series. And look, I don't know really what it was. Collectively, there was a few things that were sort of going around. You know, that we had this kind of incredible run of great form, and this is individually and collectively. Maybe we were a little complacent. I never think that we've got our Ashes series preparation in a row, you know, and in line. I don't think that we're actually in England long enough ahead of a test match series. We get distracted with 2020 tournaments and, you know, too much one-day cricket. It just doesn't work. I know, you know, having played numerous seasons of county cricket just selfishly as an opening batsman, it wouldn't be until the first month was behind me that I started to really, you know, get my game in order and start to play great cricket in England. So just time and lots of games. 93 was probably the last of the era of cricket which arrived and had a four-month season there. Mm-hmm. You know, that's decadent time for a cricketer now. It's as a commodity, you're wheeled into the next location, clicked into a particular series, you play back-to-back test matches with 3 days in between each one, and then you're flown and clicked into another series across the world. And that's just a commercial reality of the way that scheduling is run at ICC. So on this kind of 10-year rotational policy that the cricket program occupies. So, look, I think more than anything, we just weren't ready to play our best cricket. We were a bit green. There was a little bit of sort of tension off the field as well. There was a few wives that, you know, and guys that were just having a few stresses. They've been on the road together for a long time, I guess, more than anything, and that happens. There was a very close connection with Warnie and guys like Andrew Flintoff and Kevin Peterson as well, and that sort of caused some friction internally. But generally, look, they were all just, you know, excuses more than anything. And this side, as you said, was just such a well-performed side, knew all of the battles that it had together and just got home and had this boot camp, which you know, I laugh about now, but it wasn't a particularly nice thing. It was really to test out exactly, you know, were we committed to each other and were we wanting to get on with business or not, really. And what came out of a five-day extensive militant-style camp in the middle of winter with a number of key personalities was the fact that. You know, we did want to do business together. We did love each other's company and we had the best interests of the team at our heart. And we wanted to take revenge. I think that's the right word.
Yeah.
Actually, we wanted to take revenge on England because we'd been beat. We weren't happy about being beat. We believe that we were a better side, but we just had to put it together both as a partnerships, whatever that looked like, to mount that pressure on England that we knew that we were capable of doing. To deliver really what was the outcome of 2006.
Well, of course, the series opened with one of the... I guess it, along with Shane Warne's ball to Mike Gatting, the so-called ball of the century, I guess the next most famous individual delivery, certainly in English-Australian test cricket, is Harmison's opening ball, which set the tone when it hit Flintoff a second slip. You were at the non-striker's end, Matthew. What did you Do you remember that? And you think, my God, what was that?
Oh, I remember it like yesterday, but I think, look, at that particular time, we were so focused on, I mean, one ball's one ball, I mean, and cricket is a game of events. And he actually did follow it up in that same over, if you remember, an absolutely cracking delivery to Justin Langer that lifted him off his darling little feet, and he, you know, his legs swung up like he was first kiss sort of thing. And it just careered out and it fell safe and, you know, nothing was really made of it. But
no, you're right. If it had been the second ball of the series, we wouldn't even be talking about it. But because it was the first one, it appears to have set the tone. And the tone went on. I mean, let's be fair. Australia wiped the floor with England during that series. 5-0. Massive, massive victories and a whitewash. The first one in Australia since 2021, which was also
I think that series was almost the perfect side for this perfect storm for this side. It had it just had all the right ingredients to make a really solid professional group play at its absolute peak. You know, the McGraths, the Warnes. The fact that they were potentially leaving the Test match arena, and some of these venues would be the last of their time. The fact that guys were under pressure to perform, champions under pressure. I know personally, I went into that Test match feeling like, you know what, I've had a good couple of years here, but this could be my last series if I actually don't get my game face on here and play. And as you said, even in the lead up to that game. You know, I was running at my family property in Kingaroy, and the first thing I realised when I got about 3 or 4 K out of the home block that I had a dog hanging off my leg. And what I didn't realise, the fact that after I dropped to the ground and wondered why I couldn't walk or run, that he'd torn straight across my Achilles. And this was 3 weeks off, out from the game. So, you know, we all have our various challenges when we go into these series, but I had both form and also this really nasty dog injury that I had to sort of overcome in the dying stages of our preparation. And it wasn't really until the Melbourne Test match that I started to get my game face on and started to get the volume of work under my belt and get my fitness and form back into play before I even started to arrive at the series. But thankfully, you know, there was enough guys to cover that, you know. It was often said of our group that if you didn't have a good day, there would be always someone having a very good day, you know. So a Ricky Ponting sort of coming to the stage, or an Adam Gilchrist, or a Damian Martin, you know, those sort of environments where they're bringing the most out of your group were the perfect way to actually get this dynamic an outstanding group of talents on the same page.
That outstanding group. I mean, I know you had retirements. The following year, you retained the World Cup in 2007. I mean, another performance that is simply incredible in its perfection. I mean, you made over 650 runs in the one-day series. Four of the top 10 run scorers in the tournament were Australian. Four of the top 6 wicket takers were Australian. You were the one-day cricketer of the year. Glenn McGrath, who never had to walk to the centre to bat, won the was man of the series. Looking back on that Australian team you played in, the Test team, and the Australian one-day team that you played in, there's an argument that both, and it's a difficult argument, but there's an argument that both are the best one-day team and the best Test team of all time.
Well, look, it's a lovely sentiment, and it's something that it would be glorious to think that it would be an easy black and white kind of case. But the reality of it is that these tremendously gifted and talented sides had such vastly different individual and collective backgrounds to overcome. You know, like during the war-torn eras, for example, how do you rate like your Invincibles players for Australia? That 42 series, you know, where you've got you know, all sorts of challenging, desperate depression and war and, you know, uncovered wickets and, you know, this maze of stuff that these players would have had to go through, including actually just travel to destinations, which would have been gloriously fun, I would have thought as well. Like 6 months on a boat, how fun would that be?
Yeah.
But, you know, to cut a long story short, you know, I think we're as good as we could have been anyway. You know, we just believed in ourselves. We loved playing together. We had these marvellous relationships which go way beyond the sporting field. And I'll just, if I can finish on the World Cup, to give you a little example of what these tournaments mean. The World Cup in the West Indies in 2007 finished, obviously, in the dark. And I was petrified, not for the fact that we would have had to potentially, you know, lose the game or have to restart the game, but petrified because my wife was actually due with our youngest son, Thomas. And the West Indies is a really, really long way away from home. And I was desperate to have done everything I could have done to play a great World Cup series, but then I was desperate to come home and spend time with my wife and to see my son born. Anyways, I was watching, this would have been now 2 days later, I was watching as the boys are sitting up on the bow of this enormous big cruise ship, and they're bomb diving into the water. Mm-hmm. And I'm now in the lounge ahead of childbirth. This slips my mind what they call it, but sitting there watching this with no regrets, I might add, but I'm thinking, those mongrels, you know, how good a fun would that be? But you know, cricket is a great part of your life, but it's not your life. You know, beyond the sporting field, you know, I've had such a great and rich experience, whether that be on the land, through my faith, through my family, you know, through just living this great outdoors life, which I really enjoy, whether that be fishing or surfing and having the skills to do all of those things, you know, jump in a boat and go. They just add weight to what I feel is such a privileged way of life, both in living in Australia, but also having those opportunities, as I said, to play in these great grounds with these magic people up through Bury and through that sort of Lancashire League, or over in the IPL, you know, 3 seasons of playing with Chennai Super Kings and it being like a home away from home. Or my mates in South Africa who every time I ring, you know, are already sort of shaping the boards and will arrive at the airport when I come. In fact, while we're on air here, I just got a text from a guy that works with Oakley in Cape Town. And he was asking the question of, mate, when are you coming up? And he sends me these waves of Jeffreys Bay and just sort of saying, you know, like, come over, it's pumping, you know. Like,
it's surf,
so I've just had this
up.
Beautiful life. Yep, I've had a beautiful life. And cricket's been such an enormous part of the, I call it the ultimate dean of faculty, you know, to have this game which sort of sits in this authoritative position, which connects people globally, which has this participation and this unique bond, especially between Australia and England. you know, where we come to a head, but we also, you know, absolutely love sharing a big pint of, you know, whatever the best bitter is. I particularly like that Theakston's bitter. I love that stuff. but, you know, there's just this wonderful, rich sense of two countries with an amazing connection, you know, through our political system, but also just through our backgrounds. And, you know, long may it exist, because, you know, we are very, very privileged to be broadcasters as well, I might add, and to share and tell these magic stories.
It must have been quite a decision to decide to retire. Because you're still playing. You've played some more, you know, plenty more cricket up till very recently, as you say, in the IPL and all the rest of it. What was behind your decision? What finally made you say, you know what, I've done enough of this. It's time to move on to new pastures.
Well, you know, I was sitting out the back of my property, and I live on, fortunately, a couple of acres that are right in the centre of Brisbane. And I have a fondness for growing lots of stuff, all sorts of stuff. So I was sitting in the middle of this big tomato bush, and I was with my daughter, and I said to Grace, I think I just want to come home and stay, Gracie. She says, what do you reckon about that? She says, oh, no, Dad. She says, no, you can't retire. I said, what do you mean I can't retire? And they said, well, Melbourne, test match, Boxing Day. Santa, you know, if you retire, Santa won't come and visit us.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, so she'd thought that somehow that Melbourne test match, that's the only place that Santa Claus would actually come and see her.
She'd linked the two experiences together.
She'd linked the two together. But then I came up to the house, you know, like, and Stephen Moore said something which I believe is very accurate. He said, Matty, you know, if you're thinking of retirement, you've already retired.
Yeah.
And I actually believe that during that last summer against South Africa, I was starting to think about retirement more than I was thinking about the actual game itself, and I was in effect retired, and I also felt that it was kind of the coming of the next age, you know, seeing someone like Michael Clarke start to force his way up the leadership situation, seeing sort of the change of guard in terms of, you know, looking around the change rooms, and you wouldn't be seeing Shane Warne, Jason Gillespie, you know, you'd be seeing Paddo and Pete Siddle, and, you know, also really fabulous blokes, but of a different generation.
Yes, yes.
And so culturally, I felt like I'd really added as much as I possibly could to the group, and the City Test match was just the perfect time, I think, just to go, this is going to close. I've got to close the chapter of this side of my life. I was ready to finish, and I came directly into my wife after that small exchange with my daughter that I just explained, and said, love, I think it's ready for me. I'm ready to retire. And she said, are you sure? And I said, yeah, I'm as sure as you can be. Like, how do you give up something you absolutely love?
Yeah.
But I guess once you sort of set it into that sort of process, it gathers its own momentum. So, you know, I sat down and I thought carefully about the kind of people that I would want to tell and in which particular order, and how I sort of, you know, would go about, you know, just respectfully bowing to the game and just saying thank you very much. You know, it's been a wonderful experience. I really wanted my family around me as well, because, you know, it is a very emotional time in your life, letting go of something you're so passionate about. It's almost like a grieving process in a lot of ways, because the game has given you so much, but it's just also been enjoyed so much, and it's like losing your best mate in some ways. I felt like the time was right, and I felt very comfortable with the decision, and I really, really enjoyed saying goodbye to not only cricket in this country, but saying goodbye to Test cricket right across the globe. I really appreciate the amount of support that I got within the media. You know, friends that have been associated with the struggle of my Test cricket, who I learned a very valuable lesson, and that was this, that you treat people really well consistently, because on the way up, you know, they will look after you, and on the way down, they'll look after you as well. And so that was a really wonderful value system to learn.
Well, it was an incredible career, one that ended with even the Australian Prime Minister then, Kevin Rudd, congratulating you. Let me just remind people and what we're talking about here. I mean, we've heard a great deal of you about you as a person, Matthew, which I think is very important, but let's just do the cricket statistics. 6,825 runs in 103 tests, an average of over 50, 161 ODIs, over 6,000 runs there. You broke the individual test record score of 380. I think we should also mention that your partnership with Justin Langer may or may not be the greatest ever opening partnership. It's certainly statistically right up there with that between Gordon Greenidge and Desmond Haynes, the West Indian legends. It is just the most extraordinary set of figures. And as I say, for me, Matthew, the idea that you might have played, if you'd been a different nationality, you might have played another 4, 5, 6 years of Test cricket, only goes to show just how much you achieved in the time that was available to you at the very top of cricket. Thank you very much for coming to the end of our time. It's been wonderful, and I have to say slightly humbling, to spend the last 2 hours in your presence. But I'm afraid that is it for tonight's edition of My Sporting Life with Matthew Hayden. For more details on the My Sporting Life series, you can log on to TalkSport.com. If you'd like to catch up with all the many previous editions of the programme, you can do that at iTunes.
Our thanks to both Danny Kelly and Matthew Hayden for the last 90 minutes or so. And don't forget, we'll be releasing weekly episodes of the My Sporting Life series with big names such as Clive Lloyd, Curtly Ambrose and Sir Andrew Strauss all to come. As well as this, the Cricket Collective returns on Tuesday. Neil Manthorpe and Steve Harmison looking ahead to England's T20 World Cup campaign, and they will be joined by 2010 winner Ryan Sidebottom, as well as hearing exclusively from the England bowler Stuart Broad, and former T20 captain, of course. So keep an eye out for that. But this has been Following On.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.